Busy show on Tuesday, March 24th on Connecticut Today as we kept you up to date with the fast-moving and ever-changing coronavirus situation. We talked about criminal justice with a guest in the 2 p.m. hour regarding what it would look like if prisoners had to be released because of COVID-19. Then we checked in with one of our regulars. He's Greg Chris Powell, editorial writer for the Journal Inquirer of Manchester. Chris asking whether or not we're weighing the risks properly when dealing with the coronavirus. And we are together with you at 203-333-9422, 333-9422, like the man said, on two great connoisseur radio stations right now, WICC 600 and 95.9 The Fox. Listen online, too, if you have to, at WICC600.com or 95.9thefox.com on your Alexa, your Google device, whatever you use to listen online. We're always here for you 24/7. What's going to happen with prisons and prisoners If this scenario continues as far as the coronavirus is concerned? Well, our next guest has more than 40 years of experience in the criminal justice system throughout his lifetime, an assistant chief of probation in New Jersey. He's also a former past president of the New Jersey Criminal Justice Educators Association. Currently, he's a professor of criminal justice at Rider University, teaching criminal justice at both Seton Hall and Rutgers. By the way, he has written a great book, 50 Years, Working Criminal Justice, and we welcome to the phones here at WICC, Professor John Patakis. John, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
Very good, sir. Very good under the circumstances.
Yeah, we're looking at this, John, and with this extensive scenario here you have in law enforcement, you and I both read about some states possibly saying, well, we may have to release some prisoners here for their own health concerns, the concerns of correction officials, yada, yada. John, give us kind of an overlook as you have it, kind of a summarize this as what your thoughts are on it.
Well, yeah, and, you know, when we talk about the correctional system, prisons, you know, are for a year or longer for the more serious offenders. Then you have the county jails. So probably the county jails is the place to start because you got the least serious offenders. A lot of them are from a municipal court for disorderly persons, maybe a probation violation, and they have to serve 30 days in the jail. So what some states are looking at doing, in fact, I believe New Jersey is now talking about releasing about 1,000 of them if they meet the criteria, of these minor offenders with the approval ultimately of the prosecutor's office. So in other words, if the prosecutor feels that somebody's not appropriate, he can request a special interview with the judge, and they can decide. So I think that's one way to look at it. Those are the less serious because, again, whether it's a jail or a prison, they can't do the 6 feet, you know, social distancing, et cetera. So one of the things is to reduce the population to some extent. So that's one way to look at it. Now, again, you know, it's up to every state what they want to follow, but you know, realistically, that's one way. The other is, you know, to, you know, try and enhance the sanitary conditions with the jails and prisons. And that varies, again, from prison to prison, jail to jail. A lot of our institutions are very old. The newer ones may have a little bit more room. So training for correction officers and even for the inmates, you know, since they're in that locked environment. And, you know, many times they don't have all the outside information that we're getting, you know, on the outside. That generally is a starting point, you know, and then carefully looking at who comes into the prison. Now, that population, whether it's jail or prison, they've been confined. OK, so they haven't been on the outside. However, there are a lot of people coming in on a daily basis. Right. You have social workers. You have doctors. You have correction officers. You have families that or family members that can visit. Well, they're stopping visitation in most jails in prison right now. So you eliminate that interaction, and they can virtually or online somehow, you know, have the interview with their person, you know. So that's one way, another way to look at, you know, keeping that population, you know, somewhat, protected.
Yeah. John Patakis is the guest, the name of the book, 50 Years Working in Criminal Justice. John, what you say is great in theory, and I know, and I have family members, I should tell you, that work in criminal justice here in Connecticut. But there is kind of a public relations problem with this, John, because even though you explain something extremely diligently there, and a lot of it makes sense, you do have that perception that people have, like, oh, no, they're releasing criminals. How could they do this, right?
Yeah. Well, again, and I've taught criminal justice for a long time. A lot of the public, unless they've taken a course, worked in it, had a family member, have a lot of misconceptions about the criminal justice system, okay? So, not everybody, a small percentage are the very serious ones that have to be locked up for lengthier terms or whatever. 95% of that population in jails and prisons is coming out at some time during their life. And you have to understand that they can move into your neighborhood or mine or whatever. So, it's not this once a criminal, always a criminal. We're in the last 10 years putting a lot into reentry and preparing people from prison to make a satisfactory adjustment, okay? And prison populations have gone down considerably in certain states, because of that. So, again, there's another side of that, and not everybody in jail or prison is a dangerous repeat offender. You have to look at their backgrounds. So I hear what you're saying, and yes, I do see that from people who have had no further experience courses or whatever in criminal justice. And, I'm constantly, even in social functions or with relatives, trying to explain, no, this is what happens. Somebody got a 10-year sentence.
John, why are they letting those guys out, right? And you've got to hold a short course right there, right?
Well, yeah, and I do. And my wife says, you're not teaching now. I said, I know, but I have to clarify this misconception, And again, it's not about being soft on crime or hard on crime. It's being realistic and just knowledgeable on it,
What do you think, John? You said the old prisons, the new prisons, and again, I'm somewhat familiar with them, having a couple of relatives in that system. What precautions can they take in a scenario like this, John? You say, they're some of them are not very spacious and they're short-staffed as it is. Do you think any prison systems have, either on a national basis or a local basis, John, was there ever a game plan, you think, in place or at least in print for something like this?
Yeah, not specifically for this, but they all have some type of backup plan in case, let's say, there's flooding, a snowstorm, a hurricane, an earthquake or whatever. So they do, or supposedly should have. I haven't looked at every single one, but some kind of contingency plan. Now, this type of incident that happened now, probably not specifically for this, but right away what they should have been doing or should do is create that special little task force within the prison, the medical staff and the custody staff, all right? Because medical staff has to be guiding the custody staff. They're the ones that know the health issues and the medical issues, So that should happen right away and start meeting and talking about some things that you can do, even if that population is not due to get out soon, there are some medical facilities in most of the state prisons, like a hospital unit or whatever.
Yeah.
So right away, if somebody is detected with that, they should go to that hospital unit. Administrative segregation is, lock up 24 hours a day. Well, 23 hours, and you get one day out for a shower and exercise by yourself. But that's really for severe discipline problems. However, temporarily, you might have to put somebody in there until you can get the right, medical thing. Administrators also have to be pretty creative. There's a theory in management, respondent superior. Superior officer is responsible for his or her institution. I talked to an assistant warden of a major state prison recently, and I said, geez, you must be having a lot of call-outs from correction officers with this going on. He says, surprisingly, everybody's making an attempt to make sure they're here. They realize how serious it is. Now, again, I'm not saying that's all over, and, there have been a number of call-outs in a lot of other, prisons or whatever. So before anybody goes into a prison now, for the most part, they have to have their temperature checked or whatever. If they have a cold or some type of thing, then they're turned away. So whether it's a correction officer, a social worker, even a medical doctor, they're not going to be allowed in if they have some kind of problem, you know. So you got to limit that, you know, and the visitations, you know, right off the bat.
John Patakis is the guest. John, hang on. We'll need a break here. We'll come back. John Patakis, name of the book that you can check out on Amazon.com, 50 Years of Working in Criminal Justice, How Are America's Prisons Are Preparing for This. John is currently a professor of criminal justice at Rider University in New Jersey. More from John coming up first. Traffic and weather together on the sixes here. 216, it's Connecticut Today on WICC 600 and 95.9 The Fox. What about letting prisoners or certain prisoners, maybe low-level offenders, as it's being possibly presented in some states if this coronavirus thing drags on? 40 years of experience in the criminal justice system. The guest, John Patakis, we continue with him, currently a professor of criminal justice at Rider University in New Jersey. His book, by the way, 50 Years Working in Criminal Justice, available on Amazon.com. You know, John, this is a kind of a delicate, a delicate thing here, because we have to strike a balance, don't we, between society, you know, melding out whatever incarceration and punishment we deem proper for an offender. Yet there's another level here, isn't there? No matter how what they did, they're a human being, a male or a female in there, and we do have some responsibility for their health.
Yes, you're right. And, you know, and even legislatively, they have to be treated humanely. So they are entitled to psychological and medical treatment. Food standards have to meet certain requirements or whatever. So that's automatic. Now, you know, states that haven't complied, and there was a case many years ago in California, Brown versus Platt, that inmates got together, hired an attorney, sued the state of California for cruel and unusual punishment because lacked psychological services, inappropriate food services, lack of counseling, et cetera. They won the suit, okay? So, you know, automatically California was ordered to reduce the prison population by, I don't know, like 30,000 or whatever. So, again, my point is, if you don't treat them humanely, that's one thing, the civil part. But the other part is, remember what I said before, that 95% of these people are coming out. So if you treat somebody inappropriately while they're incarcerated, what makes you think that when they come out, oh, they're going to be good citizens?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, you have to start in there. And we're finally realizing that to a larger extent now. What happened in the 50s and 60s, build more prisons, strict drug laws, what did it do? It kept a lot of people in for a longer period of time. And then we saw the recidivism rates going up. Well, you know, when you're in prison, the other possibility is you become more prisonized. Look at your environment, you know. And so sometime for reasons of survival, you'll join a gang, you'll get involved in selling drugs or contraband or whatever, et cetera. But if we try more for the reentry thing, which a lot of states are doing and reducing the prison population, the recidivism rate is going down. So now research has shown that, you know. So the old model wasn't working that well. It took us a while to figure it out. But I'm encouraged by what I've seen in the last 10 years in criminal justice in certain states. I can't say universally, but even the federal system has reduced their population by doing more reentry and preparation for when they get out. Because, again, most of those people are coming out, you know. So that's the realistic side of it, you know.
And, John, once the coronavirus thing passes here, and it will, obviously, I anticipate every business, you know, from radio on down, what we do here, what you do, I anticipate every business is going to reassess what worked here, what didn't work, and I assume whether there are releases because of this virus or not, you know, the prison system and educators like you are going to be looking at this 5-10 years down the line and say, you know, this should have been done, or we could have done that better, or that worked.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, we always learn from experiences, and especially this thing that, you know, nobody ever suspected would happen is, you know, completely new. And so we'll be more fine-tuned for future things after this. But, again, I mean, you know, they always say it's good to be proactive rather than reacting, you know. And so I think we'll be more proactive, you know, in the future, and it'll be a learning thing. But, you know, in the meantime, we got to be creative and, you know, try and address it as much as possible. Let's put it that way.
And John, finally, the two kinds of people I think you touched on them previously, but a shout out, I think, too, especially with this coronavirus thing in the prisons. A, you talked about the prison guards, the correction officers. I had a couple of them who used to live in my apartment building. You know, tough as nails, hardly ever missed work. And especially in a situation like this, John, with the coronavirus, the medical people, the staff, medical people actually in the prisons who are really on the front lines here. They're on the front lines behind bars.
Right. And, they're well needed. And, from what I'm hearing, most of them are still showing up unless they're ill or whatever. And all right, you have sick days. Some are obviously calling in sick. But you're right. They are tested as well as the correction officers. Anytime somebody new comes to the prison and if their temperature is a certain amount, they're turned away or whatever. So that's the best thing you can do there. And then are we finding, people in prison already who have gotten it? And I don't think it's been any big numbers from what I've been reading and seeing so far, but, that could change.
You said it's tough inside, but in Moss, they are pretty much, I guess, bars and sliding doors, social distance people, John, to at least some extent, right?
Well, yeah, to some extent. And, they're put in different wings, et cetera. But, when you have group things or whatever, and they're even cutting back on it, I mean, there's programs that they go, they can get their GED or whatever. Now I understand teachers who were coming from the outside to teach are not coming in anymore. But what they're trying to do is give them virtual education, online. The other thing is the importance of continuing some kind of programming or whatever, because you got that anxious population in there. And, so they can't get visitors, but maybe you increase their telephone time a little bit more. Or if you have enough technology where they can do Skype, et cetera, at certain times so they can still see their relatives, So we got to be creative to also deal with their emotional things, because, again, you got that large population and you don't want a prison riot.
Especially at these times. No. Yeah. And as you say, 95% of them are coming out. Great stuff. The name of his book, by the way, 50 Years Working in Criminal Justice. We picked his brain a little on the prison system in the times of the coronavirus. He's currently a professor of criminal justice at Rider University. John Patakis. John, thank you so much. We appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right. Stuff to think about, folks. And that's one of the figures you don't really consider. And he said something interesting there. At any one time, 95% of the people in prisons are going to be coming out eventually. It's only that 5% or so that society never sees again. And again, a shout out to people who work in prisons. I have a relative of mine who does. He works as a reentry coordinator at one of the state prisons. They're going in there in this time of coronavirus, as are the prison guards. You may know a corrections officer in and about the area, Fairfield County, New Haven County, Hartford County, wherever, and the nurses, too. So if you see them, if they're in your family, if you know them in your circle, give them a thanks in this time of the coronavirus. 226, traffic and weather together. It's Connecticut Today on WICC 600 and 95.9 The Fox. We'd like to have this gentleman on as often as possible because he's a fantastic writer and writes things that need to be written, does them with eloquence and a sharpness, I think, that's well appreciated by many. I'm sure he's hunkering down somewhere. Chris Powell, are you hunkered? Are you bunkered in? Do you have enough toilet paper and macaroni and cheese?
I think I'm humpbacked in, Paul.
Yeah.
I'm doing okay, and I hope everybody else is too.
Chris, I saw that. I don't know whether you saw the story. I think it was in Yahoo News. Seriously, Kraft cannot make enough macaroni and cheese fast enough. What does that tell us, right?
Well, it's that and the toilet paper. Yeah. I heard somebody the other day say that now the toilet paper had been monetized. You could call it Buttcoin.
Thank you. Oh, very nice. I didn't even have the rim shot sound effect ready. Chris, you wrote a piece, your latest piece for the JI of Manchester. And you wrote something akin to something I read over the weekend. I know you read the same piece, too, in the New York Times. And I'm kind of reading other pieces now. Interesting comments today from the president, even from the World Health Organization, saying, well, things have to be balanced. And the point is, at what point, Chris, does the cure, as people say, become worse than the sickness for the coronavirus. I don't know if we have the answer to that. I just find it a fascinating discussion.
Yeah, all I wanted to do in that column, Paul, was to ask the question particularly and more generally about how we evaluate risk in society and how we respond to it. I think Dr. David Katz may have raised it first in the New York Times last Friday. I could tell you I had not read his column when I wrote mine, but I'm not sure you'd believe me. But the question is, how much risk do we accept? Many people have noted that we have tens of thousands of deaths in the country every year from the ordinary flu. I know from the state health department figures this year we've had at least 1,600 hospitalizations for the ordinary flu and thousands and thousands of cases of it and about 70 deaths from it. And there are no heroic actions being taken over those cases, even though they far outnumber the coronavirus cases we've had so far. People have noted that we have between 35,000 and 40,000 fatalities and traffic crashes every year, and no heroic measures are taken about that. We accept those risks. I have not really heard people explain decisively why the risk of the coronavirus is worse than the risks that we simply accept.
I guess, Chris, the thinking is that the crunch it would put on hospital beds and on our hospitals here, and you have the governor saying, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA's coming here. And I have some medical folks in the family who say it's the, you know, it's the transmissibility here of it. And you and I can talk all about that, but you're right. I think we've lost a little bit of perspective maybe when we compare all these things.
Yeah, well, certainly the hospital capacity is an urgent, compelling, worrisome issue. But we also had at least 1,600 hospitalizations from the flu so far this year, and hospitals do get crowded sometimes, and that prompted no heroic measures. Now, if people want to argue that the coronavirus is going to cause more severe cases, they may have a good point there, but we also know other things about the coronavirus, that many people contract it and don't show any symptoms at all, that more than 80% of the cases appear not to be serious and not to require hospitalization. We also know that the people most vulnerable to it are in certain high-risk groups, the frail elderly, and people who have underlying medical conditions that may have weakened their immune systems. I wonder why it is necessary to quarantine everybody rather than just the people in the high-risk groups. Now, these are questions. These are not assertions. These are not accusations that our government officials aren't doing their damnedest to protect us. I don't envy them at all. I admire the work they're doing, but I think these are legitimate, fair questions, and I know that they are shared by many people because many people have expressed skepticism to me about it, and I read skepticism elsewhere. I think they need to be addressed better.
And also, Chris, I think this also addresses, really, I think, Chris, for the first time in many of our lives, probably the vast majority of us, the fact of us being told you can't go here or you can't go there or we don't want you doing this. But I tell you, this has been like Christmas morning and Thanksgiving Day rolled into one for a lot of the anti-government conspiracy folks out there.
Yeah, and, you know, that just distracts from the real issue here. But, you know, the state's chief epidemiologist, Dr. Matthew Carter, said the other day that we'd never faced anything like the coronavirus problem here in Connecticut. And I would argue with that, or at least question it, because we've had many, many hundreds more flu hospitalizations this year and probably 6 or 7 times the deaths from flu than we've had from coronavirus. So I don't know how you can say we've never faced anything like this before.
The guest is Chris Powell from the Journal Inquirer of Manchester. Chris, when you look at the overall response, I got to tell you something. I think that, you know, by and large, Governor Lamont, I think, has done a good job here. And now that we've gotten away from arguing for at least a couple of months, who knows how long, about taxes and gambling and marijuana and tolls and all this, I don't know about you, but I think the governor's done a good job, and he seems to be in a comfort zone doing this as much as he was getting slapped around, figuratively, of course, by the General Assembly. He seems at home here.
Yeah, I have a column running tomorrow that compliments him for his work. I think he and his staff have been very conscientious and comprehensive and level-headed and not imperious like certain neighboring state governors are.
I won't have you name names. Go ahead.
Well, no, I find one nearby governor I just find very imperious and arrogant and surly, and he makes me very glad that we have Ned Lamont as our governor.
On WICC 600, 95.9 The Fox, yeah, Fairfield County, one of the considered part of one of the three or four hotspots of coronavirus in the country. We're talking about that with Chris Powell, editorialist, former managing editor of the Manchester JI, fascinating column about how we look at risk. Chris, risk as far as schools go. The governor is holding out a slight opportunity that schools might reopen about a month from now, April 20th. We're trying this distance learning thing. Other states have kind of cashed in the entire school year. You think it's worth at this point reopening the schools, or is it just better to, I don't know, figure something out as far as promotions and stuff and concentrate on maybe late August or September?
Well, I know the governor speculated today the school year might not be reconvened at all, and we might just wait till September. Hopefully, the virus will be tamped down by then. But I know it's certainly possible for people to learn over the internet electronically. I don't know that it's going to be terribly effective. But I think the bigger issue here is whether schools should have been closed at all. Some authorities have argued that since young people seem much more resistant to this virus, maybe it would have been better to keep schools open rather than to keep them crowded in with babysitters or grandparents. You know, it's another risk evaluation, but evidence is that the kids don't get it as much, and you know, how many kids would have gotten sick versus how much learning is going to be foregone. You know, it's just like the other questions: is the risk of the virus to the high risk groups worth the destruction of everybody's retirement funds and the bankruptcy of thousands of companies, yeah, and the unemployment of millions of people, and putting those people really on the verge of financial ruin? I'm not sure we're weighing these risks as thoughtfully as we should.
Yeah, it's a real, boy, I tell you, Chris, ethically, it's a tough question. And then, you know, Chris, I don't know whether your mind has wandered or mine has, but what happens after this? We get this mess cleaned up and, you know, maybe here in Connecticut, big time because of the insurance industry and other industries we have. And what will a workplace look like in the coming years? Because you know damn sure, Chris, there are efficiency experts going to look at this and say, wait a minute, you got 98% of your work done and you had no people in the building.
Well, if you know? Indeed the work got done, you know, yeah. I'm in a business where people, you know, can work if almost anywhere, as long as they've got a computer and an internet connection. Yeah. Their productivity has to be closely measured, and I think everybody's productivity has to be closely measured. And I'm not sure it's always better when people are supposedly working at home. I can show you a case or two in state government recently where people were supposedly working from home, and one guy was working from Florida.
Chris, just
getting his retirement benefits qualified.
When you are in a workplace, maybe not for every business, for every person, but I was talking about this with one of my coworkers here at the station earlier today. I said, you know, for a lot of us, there's a workplace mentality. You know, you get on your game face when you get to the newsroom or the studio or whatever, at least in this business, and you know that in your business as well, where, you know, when you're home, you've got a million things going on, and I don't know, maybe that's just me, but I think you know where I'm coming at on this.
Yeah, well, I think people who are working in what's called the gig economy, who are being paid as piecework, may be a little more productive when they're working at home rather than in an office. I certainly think supervision is generally a lot easier in an office, Paul. But I think really we should be paying more attention now to therapies, to cures for the virus. A vaccine is not going to be helping us for, you know, probably a year. But there's very strong evidence that there are cures available for the virus right now. Almost 3 weeks ago, it was pointed out to me by a friend in the pharmaceutical business, some research in China that had been translated into English and was posted on the Internet about the efficacy of hydroxychloroquine and remdesivir, which the president was talking about at a press conference a few days ago. Actually, that information was available 3 weeks ago if you knew where to look at it. I happen to know a couple of people outside the country who are pretty convinced that they were cured last week by an emergency shipment of hydroxychloroquine from a friend of mine in the pharmaceutical business in Canada. I've read personal testimonies of people who feel that they were saved by remdesivir. Now, if you read very closely a couple of days ago, you saw that Governor Cuomo said that the federal government was sending New York State 70,000 hydroxychloroquine tablets and Zithromax, which is an antibiotic that works with hydroxychloroquine, and one other of these experimental drugs. I'm trying to find out. Well, they're not experimental drugs. They've been around for a while, but they're experimental in regard to the virus.
It's an off-label use, yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to find out from the governor's office if we in Connecticut are trying to get these tablets out of the federal government or other sources, and whether we're putting them to trial use here in Connecticut. We're starting to have deaths. I think we have at least 11. I don't think anyone would object to what's called compassionate use for people who are near death to use these unapproved medicines on them. But I think that's really where we should be concentrating right now. I think there is powerful evidence that there are effective drugs against this. Maybe not complete cures, but effective drugs. Once this virus gets into people's lungs, if, you know, fills them up with mucus and they drown, and this is urgent. And I hope we can find out if these drugs that have shown some effectiveness are being put to use now in Connecticut.
Absolutely. Good question, Chris. Let me know. Send me a message when you finally find that out. I'd love to hear what you find out. Chris Powell, you can read him in the Journal Inquirer of Manchester, a couple of columns a week. Always stellar reading. Chris, good to hear from you. We'll be in touch. Thanks, man.
Thanks much, Paul.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. All right. Check him out, folks.